Support for the Think Podcast comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering courses in art, literature, film, history, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. You can register online now for the upcoming fall programs at smu.edu/CAPE.
For more than half a century, just about every American knew who Muhammad Ali was, and everyone had an opinion about him. First, he was the brash, trash-talking young champion who helped reinvigorate the sport of boxing. Then he was an outspoken advocate for racial justice and opponent of the Vietnam War. Later, a tireless, if quieter, crusader locked in a decades-long battle with Parkinson's. In those decades, many Americans came to see Ali as a hero. By the time he died last year, he was an American legend. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Yes, Ali's funeral was attended by celebrities and political luminaries who spoke of his physical grace, his humor, and his important influence on civil rights and black pride. But make no mistake, Ali was a hero as complicated as the country he inspired and sometimes infuriated, and a man full of contradictions that my guest believes we can't ignore if we want to truly understand him. Jonathan Eig is a contributing writer to The Wall Street Journal and author of the new book, Ali, A Life. Jonathan, welcome to Think.
Thanks.
So most people know that Ali was born Cassius Clay. He grew up with working class parents in Louisville, Kentucky. From early in his life, he understood that he lived in a society where black people were not treated the same as white people.
He was obsessed with that. I think everybody, if you were black growing up in the 40s and 50s, you had it in your face all the time. You couldn't go to the same stores. You couldn't go to the same restaurants as white people. Cassius Clay was particularly intrigued. He asked his mother, well, because she's lighter skinned than his father, could she do things that he couldn't? He would ask why he couldn't get rich just because he was black. He didn't understand. He would ask why all the paintings in his church were of a white Jesus. How did we know Jesus was white? He was asking a lot of interesting questions from an early age, and I think that suggested that he was not really happy with the answers he was getting.
So he was very smart, and it's evident when you hear him talking, especially early on. He's doing these like free-form rhymes, and he is just very good with language, very witty. But he graduated from school with a diploma that basically said you weren't absent too many times. What went wrong for him in school?
Well, I think he was dyslexic. His wife told me that very dyslexic was the term that she used. And it explains a lot because he's clearly bright. He's clearly very good with words, but he has trouble reading. And he has trouble reading, and that forces him to look for other ways to get attention. He's desperate for attention and for affection. And he becomes the class clown. He's the one who's doing the most outrageous things, tricks on his bicycle. And then he discovers boxing. And here's a great way for him to get attention and something that does not require him to read at all.
It was so interesting to me to find out that his friends who grew up with him didn't remember him as being a star athlete in everything. He fell into boxing almost by accident.
Yeah, they said he wasn't very good at football and baseball, and he really didn't show much interest in those things because he couldn't be alone on the, you know, he didn't want to be in football because they covered up his face with the helmet, and he's too pretty for that. And he didn't like getting banged around, although obviously he picked a sport where he got banged around even more. But he fell into boxing accidentally. He just discovered his bicycle was stolen one day, and he went looking for a police officer and found one running a boxing clinic in the basement of a gym. And he just loved it from the minute he saw it, in part because black and white people could get in the ring together. And here's a place where the rules of race, the classifications, the lines were down. You could do things here that you couldn't do anywhere else.
What made him a good boxer?
For one thing, it was his speed. He had amazing reflexes. And some people have told me that it may have been the dyslexia may have helped him with that. Because when you're dyslexic, you pick up visual clues that other people don't. The process of learning to read rewires your brain in ways that are good and bad. But when you don't learn to read, and Ali never really learned to read until much later in life, certain visual clues are apparent to you that might not be apparent to others. So he was able to maybe see the punches coming a little sooner than other opponents. And he had this tremendous speed, tremendous quick jab, never really learned proper boxing technique because he didn't have to. He was so fast.
What was the rope-a-dope strategy exactly?
The rope-a-dope strategy is something that came later in his career, much later, second half, when he started to slow down and couldn't get out of the way of those punches quite as much. He would instead rest against the ropes and let his opponents hit him until the opponents got tired. And then Ali would come back and try to win late in the round, late in the fight, And it was a tragic strategy, actually, because it ended up causing him a lot of damage that he didn't really need to take.
I've always wondered this about boxing. Full disclosure, I'm not a fan because the idea of building up your body just to have somebody come along and break it back down again is hard for me to watch. But I know people love it, and I know that there is great skill required. I've wondered what boxers do with the anger they must feel when a punch really hurts. Like, on the one hand, you can use that to fight back, right? But there are rules. You can't lose control of your emotions. What do you know about how Ali dealt with the emotions he felt in the ring?
You know, he always said that he viewed this very clinically, that this was a contest, and he studied his opponents, and he thought about the strategy and best way to win. But I think that that's a little bit deceptive. This is a brutal sport, and it's basically combat, and you have to have a killer instinct to succeed in boxing. You also have to know not to lose your cool and to keep your hands up and not just start going crazy trying to hurt your opponent in anger. But there's definitely a brutality involved, and you have to have a willingness to inflict pain on someone else, and not everybody can do that.
You mentioned that he loved attention. When he was starting out, before people knew the name Cassius Clay, or later Muhammad Ali, he would help promote his own fights.
Yeah, even when he was an amateur, and nobody had ever heard of this before. There were Friday night fights. They were on television in Louisville, and you'd get the kids, you know, would get $5 for fighting, and young Cassius Clay would go walking around neighborhoods that he didn't even know, white neighborhoods, knocking on doors saying, "Hey, I'm fighting. I'm going to be on TV Friday night. Make sure you watch." One day he knocked on his trainer's door by accident, didn't even know. And the trainer said, "What are you doing?" And he said, "I'm out drumming up interest for the fights." But he didn't make any. He still made the same $5 no matter how many people showed up. He just wanted as many eyeballs on him as possible. And that was something that continued for the rest of his life.
When he started boxing, Jonathan, the sport was somewhat in the decline, right? People were not as big on it as they had been, and he would help to generate a lot of new interest. But what was it that he brought to the sport when he was well known that made people who had sort of given up on it want to go back?
Well, you know, boxers in the past were considered great athletes. They were considered heroes for their strength, but they weren't really entertainers. They were mainly dour men who, and sometimes they appeared to be thugs, or at the very least, you know, tough guys, but not people who would charm you on the Johnny Carson show or, you know, pal around with celebrities. And Ali was something completely new in that way. And the fact that he was black, and that he had this wit, and that he had this ability to provoke people to challenge white people, to try to get under their skins, to make them think differently. He was just of an entirely different order. He was much more than just a boxer. He was a celebrity from the beginning.
I'm not going to help nobody get something my Negroes don't have. If I'm going to die, I'll die now, right here fighting you. If I'm going to die, you my enemy. My enemies are white people, not Viet Cong or Chinese or Japanese. You my opposer when I want freedom. You my opposer when I want justice. You my opposer when I want equality. You won't even stand up for me in America for my religious beliefs, and you want me to go somewhere and fight, but you won't even stand up for me here at home.
That was actually a cut that I was going to play a little bit later, but we can talk now about his interest in politics and in arguing against the Vietnam War was very much about the way that black Americans were treated in this country. It felt to him like an injustice that he would be drafted for a conflict in a country that didn't take care of black people.
You know, it was very interesting to watch Ali's position on this evolve, because like a lot of people, especially like a lot of young men who were thinking about whether to leave the country or find some other way to avoid service in Vietnam, Ali's mind changed. When he was first informed that he might be drafted, he said, "I don't want to go. I don't care about that war. You can use my tax dollars to buy bomber jets and kill all the Vietnamese you want. Send some football players over there. They're bigger than me." And then he began to say, "Well, it's really not right to send black people over there. Black people are dying in that war, disproportionate numbers, and I can't even get treated equally here in this country. Why should I fight for a country that treats me like a second-class citizen?" And then he evolved further and said, "Well, it's against my religion. I'm a member of the Nation of Islam, and we don't believe in fighting wars unless they're holy wars." So he changed his story a little bit as time went by, but eventually he came to settle on the argument for pacifism, and that's the one he took to the Supreme Court and was ultimately vindicated with.
some people might see those changing positions as evolution and a development of you know, his thinking on the subject. Some people might say he was grasping at straws and looking for what worked.
That's right. And other people would say he was basically just doing whatever Elijah Muhammad told him to do. Elijah Muhammad was the leader of the Nation of Islam, who had been sentenced to prison for refusing to fight in World War II, and who's told his children and told his disciples that they weren't going to fight for America either. And some people would say that Ali was just parroting whatever Elijah Muhammad told him to say.
Talk a little bit about the relationship between those two. Certainly there was a lot to appeal to young Cassius Clay in what Elijah Muhammad had to say. And Elijah Muhammad recognized that having an up-and-coming star in the Nation of Islam was good for the organization.
That's right. Ali, very early on, was interested in race issues, but he also was never really comfortable with the civil rights movement. He saw it as too mainstream. He wanted to be different. And what appealed to him about the Nation of Islam was that it was completely outside the ordinary. They said, "We don't believe in integration. We don't even believe in civil rights. We want our own country. Just forget it all. Forget about America. We were brought here as slaves. They treated us like slaves. They gave us slave names, and we're never going to be accepted here." And Ali loved that. It really appealed to him because it was so radical and so different. And he became an absolutely loyal follower of Elijah Muhammad. And at times that put him crosswise with people like Martin Luther King, who said Ali should stick to boxing. He doesn't know what he's talking about.
And of course, the Nation of Islam wanted to dictate who he was married to and what his personal relationships looked like.
Yeah, one of the things that I really struggled to understand the most was, you know, Ali met and married a woman named Sanji, his first wife, and many people said that was his one true love, that he was absolutely head over heels, and the Nation of Islam drove them apart, and Ali was ordered basically to divorce her because she wouldn't comply with the rules of the Nation of Islam. She wouldn't dress conservatively, and she wouldn't attend the services, and Ali had faced a really difficult choice there. You know, is he going to be loyal to his wife, his one true love, or is he going to be loyal to Elijah Muhammad? He chose Elijah Muhammad.
How do you think he justified that decision to himself?
He believed that Elijah Muhammad was a prophet of God and that this was the word from God. Whatever Elijah Muhammad said was to be followed. The same thing happened with Malcolm X. Malcolm X was his dear, dear friend, his mentor, and Elijah Muhammad cut ties with Malcolm and told Ali to do the same, and Ali turned his back on Malcolm.
It's really interesting. There were multiple times when Ali just sort of blew up friendships that were really important to him. You write about a time years later when he was going to fight Joe Frazier, and they had been really close, and then Ali was trash-talking him in ways that ultimately hurt, like he was calling him an Uncle Tom and saying these terrible things. And it was perplexing to Joe Frazier that it maybe wasn't just something that was set up for the cameras. It felt real to him.
Ali was really vicious to Frazier, and maybe it's part of the extension of being vicious in the ring and feeling like you need to dismantle your opponent, you need to dehumanize him, you have to take away his manhood. There's this really lovely scene in the book between Frazier and Ali where they're in a car together, and there's a tape recorder rolling, so all this dialogue is recorded. And they're just having a great time. They're singing songs. They're sort of teasing each other a little bit. And Ali's out of boxing at the time. And Frazier offers him a job. And Ali begs him for the job, actually. And Frazier says, "Yeah, I'll give you the job. But I don't want you to be humiliated by having to work for me. Why don't you just take some money? I'll lend it to you. And you pay me back when you're back in the ring. And I'll work to try to help get you your next fight." It's a sweet moment. And then as soon as Ali's back in the ring, he's taunting Frazier, calling him an Uncle Tom, calling him, you know, a gorilla, just horrible things that really hurt Frazier. He never got over that pain.
My guest is biographer Jonathan Eig. He's a contributing writer to the Wall Street Journal and author of the new book, Ali, A Life. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find us on Twitter @KERAThink.
Support for the Think Podcast comes from the SMU Doctor of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening doctoral program where you can distinguish yourself personally and professionally. More at smu.edu/DLS.
wrestled with an alligator. I done tussled with a whale. I done handcuffed lightning, throw thunder in jail. That's bad. Only last week, I murdered a rock, injured a stone, hospitalized a brick. I'm so mean, I make medicine sick.
Bad dude.
Bad.
Fast.
Last night, I cut the light off my bedroom, hit the switch, was in the bed before the room was dark.
Incredible.
Fast.
Incredible.
And you, George Fullman, all of you chumps are gonna bow when I whoop him. All of you. I know you got him. I know you got him picked, but the man's in trouble. I'm gonna show you how great I am.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. That was Muhammad Ali in September of 1974 at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in New York giving a press conference. My guest is his biographer, Jonathan Eig, who's a contributing writer to the Wall Street Journal. The new book is called Ali, A Life. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. It had to have been fun, Jonathan, going back and listening to these recordings.
You could spend all day just watching Ali on YouTube. And in fact, that's what Ali did for many years. His wife told me that was his favorite thing, to Skype with the grandchildren and just to watch himself on YouTube. And I would too if I were Ali. He was amazing.
It's poignant because at the time YouTube was available to him, he was old and sick. And at this moment, he was young and every bit as beautiful as he said.
Yeah, he was spectacular. I mean, he was the most handsome man, the biggest, the strongest, the fastest. All the bragging that he did was true. He really was entitled to brag.
Was he a narcissist?
Yeah, probably so. I mean, the way he treated other people was funny because he could meet the humblest person on the street and spend all day with him and welcome into his life and become friends forever. And then he would just ignore the people around him. Sometimes his own wives, his children wouldn't get to see him very much. He was just so, you know, entirely wrapped up in himself sometimes. It was really interesting to see that conflict within him.
Was he an abusive husband?
Yeah, he was pretty bad to his wives. He cheated on them relentlessly and often with their knowledge and even with their participation. You know, sometimes he would ask his wife to book an extra room for the mistress he was bringing along on the trip or the mistresses he was bringing along on the trip and would let them know which nights he would be with which women. It was rough. And at least once I know, you know, his wife said that she'd been struck by him. So I was, you know, very disturbed by some of the stuff I learned.
So we know that he had Parkinson's syndrome, which is different than Parkinson's disease. How much did that have to do with the number of hits he took?
Well, I think it had a lot. I think it had everything to do with it. And his doctor, when he was diagnosed, said he thought this was as a result of the punches. So I did two things when I researched this book. One is I set out to try to count the number of punches that Ali was hit with. And I worked with CompuBox, which is a company that does boxing stats. And they counted every punch from every fight that we have on film. And then we extrapolated that to his amateur fights, to his exhibitions, to his sparring sessions. And we calculated that he was probably hit about 200,000 times. Then I worked with scientists at Arizona State who study speech patterns. And we looked at Ali's speech, and you can see that he starts to lose his ability to speak, his words become slower over time, and you can correlate it directly to the fights. As the fights go on, he loses more and more speaking ability.
Just at the top of this break, we heard him in 1974. I want to listen now to a cut of him being interviewed in Newcastle, England in 1977, just 3 years later.
I don't mean boxing will be finished. It'll just be flying a lot lower than it is now, a lot slower. Like, for an example, the Concorde, the airplane. If you take Concorde, if you were a pilot, or if you were a passenger who flew on the Concorde, or if you were a pilot, then you might say if the Concorde is no longer flying, that's the end of flying. It's not the end of flying per se. There'll be props and helicopters and this and that, but there'll be no more fast, good trips like the Concorde. So there'll be boxing when I'm out, but there'll be no more portrait.
You listen to that and you think maybe he's tired, maybe he's been drinking, but it doesn't sound like the same person.
No, and we studied hundreds of videos and we charted them over time, and you can see the decline. And in particular, after certain fights, you see a sharp decline. In 1977, he fought Ernie Shavers, and that was just a brutal, brutal fight. And he lost something like 16% of his speaking rate just in the days after that fight. And then if he'd rest a while, the speaking rate would start to come back up. But he didn't rest very often. Even late in his career, when he could have been coasting, when he didn't really need to be fighting that much anymore, he continued to fight a lot. And he was fighting big, strong guys. These were not pushovers.
There were people on his team who said, you've got to stop.
Yeah, even Elijah Muhammad told him after the Foreman fight in Zaire, it's over. You know, you've proven everything there is to prove. You've made tens of millions of dollars. Stop. Go do something else. Preach for Islam, but stop boxing. And he couldn't stop. He needed the money. He blew through most of his money over the course of his life, and he loved the attention. He had this entourage that was counting on him to keep going, and he wouldn't listen.
Counting on him and sometimes stealing from him.
Yeah, that too. He didn't care about money. He just let people rip him off. If he was confronted with this, he would say, well, he must have needed it. And he wouldn't even fire the guy sometimes. There's a beautiful story that Angelo Dundee told. Angelo Dundee was his trainer, and he said one day this guy came in the gym, and he had both legs amputated, and he's wearing a Dodgers cap. And Angelo said, Ali, that's not Roy Campanella. He's a con man. He's going to come in here. He's going to tell you it's Roy Campanella, the former Dodgers catcher who was in a car accident. Don't give him any money. And Angelo turns around, and there's Ali taking out a big roll of cash and handing it to the guy. And Angelo runs up to him and says, why'd you do that? I told you it was a con man. And he says, yeah, but Ange, we got legs. And that was Ali.
Jonathan, when you and I were growing up, Ali was like doing Raid commercials. And I wonder if that kind of thing felt like a step down for him, or if he didn't care, he just wanted the cash.
Yeah, he would sign almost anything. He would put his name on any kind of a product. And it's sad that, you know, he wasn't getting the Coca-Colas and the Pepsi deals, but partly that was his own fault because he had signed away the rights to Champ Cola for $20,000 in cash, and then he couldn't do Coke or Pepsi.
Like early on, he said, I will never do an ad for another soft drink, not realizing how many millions that could have brought him.
Exactly. And he just made a lot of bad decisions and trusted a lot of people around him who didn't always have his best interests at heart.
All right, I want to go to the phones. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Seth is calling from Justin. Hi, Seth.
Hello, Chris. Lovely show. I'm a big boxing fan. And I just had a question for your interviewee. Did you get much history on his interaction with his children and if maybe he took any of his political, religious views and if he structured any of that for his children to hand down? Anything like that?
You know, I talked to some of Ali's children, and he wasn't around much in their childhoods. Some of them were raised by grandparents. Some of them were raised by the moms. So they didn't know him that well during their childhoods. And some of them are Muslim today, and some of them are not. So I don't think he was really hands-on and pushing them to take one religious view or another. I think he left it up to them for the most part.
How big an impact on his career did it have when he began to tell people to call him Muhammad Ali? Because as you discovered, he may not ever have legally changed his name.
Yeah, I don't think he ever legally changed it. Maybe much later when he began branding himself in ways that he might have legally changed it. But early on, he didn't. It was a huge cultural event, and it made him arguably the most unpopular man in America. First, when he comes up, he's just a loudmouth, and people don't like him for that. Then he announces that he's joining the Nation of Islam, which is considered a threat to democracy. The FBI considers them a terrorist group. And then he says he won't fight in the war. People just thought he was crazy and that he was dangerous. And most of the American press refused to acknowledge his new name. They kept calling him Cassius Clay for years and years to come, as if he didn't have the right to change his own name.
Did he regret the years he lost in the ring because of his activism against the Vietnam War?
You know, it's funny. With Ali, everything is complicated. He said he absolutely would do the same thing again. He would never compromise his beliefs about the Nation of Islam and about his, you know, his refusal to fight in the war. But when he was asked in the 70s for his biggest regret in life, did he have anything he would do differently? He said he wished he hadn't made so many people angry with his position on Vietnam. So he was glad he took the move. He was glad he made the move and took the stance, but he was upset that he made people angry. So he wanted to follow his religious beliefs, but he also wanted to be loved. And he had these warring impulses to be loved and also to provoke. And that made things very difficult for him sometimes.
So by most accounts, he was a devout believer in Islam. He did a lot of things that were not allowed. He would be with prostitutes before fights. He, as you mentioned, married and divorced multiple times, had affairs while he was married. Did he view himself as a flawed person trying to do what his religion required of him?
you know, he absolutely recognized his errors in judgment and his sins. Late in life, he would talk about the fact that there was a tallying angel, tallying all the good things he'd done and the bad things, and that if he could make up for some of the bad things, if he could score more points on the good side, he would go to heaven. And if he failed to score enough points on the good side, he would go to hell. And he talked about hell being, you know, very vivid terms, that it was like having your hand on a frying pan for all eternity. And he said that he was determined to make up for some of the mistakes he'd made.
All right, back to the phones. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Jack is calling now from Denton. Hi, Jack.
Hey, Chris. Enjoy the show as always.
Thanks.
This show reminded me very quickly of an instance when I was an undergrad at the University of North Texas, being a political science major. The professor was standing in class, and the building where the classes were held overlooked the commons area, and she said, I think we need to pay attention to the speech that's going on out in the commons right now. And she said, I think you will remember this as a significant happening in your college life. And this was during the days of Cassius Clay, and he was at his height of his Vietnam his speeches, and that did prove to be it's been a very vivid memory of that point in his life when he was touring the country giving those speeches.
Yeah, you know, when he was out of boxing, he had no way to make money, really, and those speeches, which he would often do for $500 or at most $2,000 or $3,000 if he could get that much, that's how he supported himself. And he and his wife and his manager would drive around the country just going from one campus speech to another. He didn't really ever get involved in the Vietnam protests. He never got involved in the marches in the streets, but he really liked going to those college campuses and engaging with these young students, particularly white audiences. He felt like it was really a nice way to provoke arguments.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Jonathan Eig, a contributing writer to the Wall Street Journal and author of the new biography, Ali, A Life. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. So certainly, Jonathan, Muhammad Ali was not the first prominent black athlete who had fans across the racial spectrum. He was one of the first who refused to follow the rules that white America had set up, which was that if you were a black person who had a lot of success, you had to sort of walk through the world with a spirit of gratitude and humility.
That's right. And Joe Louis was expected to follow certain rules. He wasn't even allowed to like raise his hands in celebration in the ring because that would be seen as too cocky for a black man. And when Ali wins the championship in 1964 and beats Sonny Liston, the very first thing he says is, I don't have to do what you tell me to do. I don't have to be what you want me to be. I'm free. And that was a monumentally rebellious statement. That was like a declaration of war, really, because nobody had thrown down the gauntlet like that before. And he infuriated people with that. And then announced that he was no longer going to accept his Christian name, that he was no longer going to accept Christianity, that he was baptized, but he didn't know what he was doing at that time, and he was going to be a Muslim now. And people were furious.
He was named for his father. They called his father Cash. How did his parents take his announcement of a name change?
They were upset. They first of all thought Cassius Clay was the most beautiful name, and it was a beautiful name. But they felt like he was being brainwashed. They didn't trust the Nation of Islam. They thought they were after their son for his money, and that it was a frightening group. And they were good Christians. They were, you know, loyal Americans, and they thought that this was a terrible thing for their son to do. And both their sons, they complained that their sons were being stolen from them.
Clay, later Ali, did have some white supporters and benefactors, especially in Louisville, but they were like weirdly paternalistic at the same time. Can you talk about those relationships?
Yeah, it was very unusual. When Ali came back from the Olympics with his gold medal, this group of white businessmen decided to take over his career and to manage him and to build a trust fund for him and put him on a salary and pay all his expenses. It was probably the greatest deal financially that a young boxer had ever been presented with. And they were really not in it for the money. They were in it for the civic pride that they could help a Louisville kid make something of himself and it would be good for the city. And of course it was paternalistic, but most relationships in those days with when you're dealing with wealthy white people and black people working for them were paternalistic too. But it was very much to Ali's benefit in many ways. But when he broke with them and when he joined the Nation of Islam and said he was going to hire black people to take over his management career, he remained very grateful and always said he appreciated what those Louisville businessmen had done. And Ali, he was going around calling white people the blue-eyed devils and saying that white people would never be trusted. At the same time, he had a white trainer, he had a white manager, he loved palling around on TV with Howard Cosell. You know, he was a hard guy to pin down in that way.
All right, help me understand the relationship between Ali and Howard Cosell.
Oh, it's so much fun to watch them on TV together. I think that they both recognized that they were really good for their careers, that this was a business arrangement. I don't think it was a deep personal friendship. I don't think they dined at home together. But Ali loved clowning around. He loved being on TV and loved yucking it up. And he found this perfect foil in Howard Cosell. And Cosell was one of the few, to his credit, one of the few journalists at the time who respected Ali's right to have whatever religion he wanted, perhaps because Cosell was Jewish. If Ali wanted to be a Muslim, if Ali wanted to change his name, Cosell showed support for that. So I think they had a nice relationship in that way.
All right, back to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. Umar is calling from Dallas. Hi, Umar.
Hello, how are you?
Very well.
Enjoy the show.
Thanks.
I'm just curious about, as Ali got older, one thing I never understood. What was his relationship with W.D. Muhammad, Warsaw D. Muhammad, particularly after the death of Elijah Muhammad in 1975, and moving forward to the rest of his life and his relationship with the greater Muslim community outside of the nation, definitely going into the 1980s and 90s.
Umar, those are great questions. We have to take a quick break now, so we will get an answer from my guest, Jonathan Eig, in just a moment. The book we're talking about is Eig's new biography. It's called Ali, A Life. It's about the life of Muhammad Ali. If you would like to join the conversation, we have lines open at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find us on Twitter at @KERAThink.
Support for the Think Podcast comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening master's program for working professionals. You can apply now for the fall of 2017. More at smu.edu/MLS.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Wall Street Journal contributing writer Jonathan Eig. His new biography is called Ali, A Life. You can join us at 800-933-5372. Before the break, we heard from Umar, who wanted to know, after Elijah Muhammad's death, what Ali's relationship was to W.D. Muhammad.
Yeah, he followed Elijah's son, W.D., and Elijah Muhammad's son eventually broke up the Nation of Islam and took his followers into more orthodox Islam. And Ali went along and followed him and became much more traditional Muslim at that point. At around the same time, Louis Farrakhan decided to rebuild the Nation of Islam and to rebuild it in the image of Elijah. And I interviewed Louis Farrakhan about that, and he said he went to Ali and asked him to come with him and to stay with the old form of the Nation of Islam and to rebuild the teachings of Elijah Muhammad. And Ali told him no, that he was not going to come along, and he stuck with the more orthodox view of the religion.
How did it happen that people who had feared or reviled Muhammad Ali, I'm thinking particularly of sort of white establishment figures, came to embrace him to such an extent? He was winning awards, and his funeral was really well attended. We can listen here now to him receiving the Presidential Medal of Freedom from George W. Bush in 2005.
Far into the future, fans and students of boxing will study the films, and some will even try to copy his style. Certain things defy imitation. The Ali Shuffle. the lightning jabs, the total command of the ring, and above all, the sheer guts and determination he brought to every fight. This is a man who once fought more than 10 rounds with a fractured jaw. And he fought to complete exhaustion and victory in that legendary clash of greats in Manila. The real mystery, I guess, is how he stayed so pretty. Probably had to do with his beautiful soul. He was a fierce fighter, and he's a man of peace. Just like Odessa and Cassius Clay Sr. believed their son could be. Across the world, billions of people know Muhammad Ali as a brave, compassionate, and charming man. And the American people are proud to call Muhammad Ali one of our own.
Jonathan, did Muhammad Ali change or did America change?
Both. You know, the writer Stanley Crouch said that Ali, when he started out, was a grizzly bear. He was wild. He's dangerous. Then he becomes, in the 70s, more like a circus bear. He's still dangerous, but he's entertaining. And then in the third act, he's a teddy bear, and we just want to cuddle with him. And some of that's our fault. You know, we shouldn't love him just because he's cuddly. We should remember that he was important because he was dangerous. But you start to see the changes happening as America changes. When the civil rights era moves, when the protests move off the streets and into the courts, when the Vietnam War becomes unpopular, then Ali is redeemed to a certain extent, and he suffered for his beliefs. He was banned from boxing for 3.5 years. He comes back. He gets knocked on his butt by Joe Frazier. He has to get up and fight his way back to the championship. So we've changed. We see him more sympathetically now. We see him as a martyr. And then we see him getting beat up and getting slower and losing his ability to speak clearly, and we feel bad for him. So this evolution is really why today we see him as this sort of saintly figure.
Do you think if he hadn't gotten sick, that transformation would have happened?
Hard to say, because he would have been out there causing trouble. He would have been out there making enemies and saying controversial things and perhaps doing things that, you know, didn't reflect well on him as well. So it's impossible to know. But I think the fact that he is rendered seemingly harmless for all those decades really changed his image.
All right, I want to go to the phones once again. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. Lynn is calling us from Pasadena. Hi, Lynn.
Hi, how are you doing?
Very well.
Yes, I would like to know if the people that Muhammad Ali trashed, if they forgave him or they saw that as a way of promoting himself. And did they forgive him like before, you know, he was much too older and far in, you know, his age?
You know, it was really hard to hate Ali. He was just such a likable guy. But these are warriors. You know, these are men who put everything they had into these fights. And I found that once you talk to them for a little while, guys like George Foreman and Larry Holmes, they would reveal that they were still angry. Foreman told me that he thought he was cheated in that fight, that he was drugged by his own manager. And you can tell that the reason he's still saying that is because he's still mad that he lost. He's still mad at Ali for the way Ali treated him, too. And as much as they all want to pay homage to Ali now and talk about what a wonderful guy he was, there's still that burning anger underneath it for many of them.
All right. Let's speak next with Frank in Houston. Hi, Frank.
Hello.
Hi. Go right ahead, please.
I just want to tell you that I was a bellman at the Hotel America when he used to come stay there.
Mm-hmm.
Quite a character, for one thing. And he just always telling jokes and really nice guy. Well, one of the things that happened when I was there is somebody asked him, said, why don't you go ahead and go in the Army? And he looked at all of us. There was about five or six of us standing around. And he says, well, he says, the black Muslims, they killed Malcolm X, and they told me they would kill me if I refused, if I didn't do this, and all my family. And we said, okay. So I thought I'd throw that out there. That actually happened right there in the lobby of the Hotel America.
Thanks for your call. Can you give us some perspective on what Frank remembers?
Well, there were people who felt like maybe Ali was responding out of fear, that he was afraid of what the Nation of Islam might do to him. He did say later in the 70s, he spoke openly about it. He said that he was afraid to leave the Nation of Islam for a while because he feared that he could be hurt, that he could be killed the way they had Malcolm X. But I don't know that he ever said it during the 60s. I think it was only later upon reflection that he said that.
All right. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. Kevin is calling now from Benbrook. Hi, Kevin.
Hi. How you doing?
Very well, thanks.
Say, I'm wondering if it would be fair to situate Ali in a broader historical context. I'm thinking of W.B. Du Bois and Booker T. Washington, sort of post-Reconstruction, with Ali being more in the tradition of Du Bois and what white America wanted him to be, being more the Booker T. Washington sort of accommodation with what the white view of the black man, could be. Any thoughts about that?
Yeah, I think that there's definitely a place to put Ali in that kind of perspective. Ali's father was a Garveyite who believed that the only way black people were going to make it in this country was to get out of this country and go back to Africa. And obviously that's something Elijah Muhammad believed too, that America would eventually be forced to give up a couple of states where black people can go and live and have their own place to themselves. And Ali was opposed to the civil rights movement. He said integration was a waste of time, that if you wanted to bother integrating your schools and your neighborhoods, if you wanted white and black people living on the same block, that's fine, go for it. But he wanted no part of it. And he openly opposed mixed marriages. He said it was a terrible mistake, that nobody wanted a bunch of mixed kids running around. So Ali was controversial on that front, but he was definitely more on the Du Bois side than on the Douglas side.
It's interesting because when we remember him as a civil rights hero, it's really easy to dismiss some of the more difficult things that he said and believed that don't really track with the way most people interested in civil rights today think.
That's a big part of why I wanted to write this book, because we don't really do Ali or any other historical figure a favor by making him out to be a saint or by turning him into a figure for Mount Rushmore. We need to remember that these were people and they were complicated, and Ali was very complicated. His views were controversial, and we should remember him for the fact that he was hated as well as that he was loved.
Was he an introspective person?
No, everything came out. Not too many thoughts went unexpressed. Mm-hmm. He was always talking, and he was sometimes think, but now he wasn't always thinking and talking at the same time.
All right, let's go next to Muhammad in Dallas. Hi, Muhammad.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes, thank you. I appreciate the show. I just want to give a comment. I was, 1990, I was in London, and exactly in Times Square, and I'm seeing this guy. At that time, YouTube was not that widespread, but I saw him in Times Square distributing flyers, and I was thinking to myself, "Wow, this is super powerful guy like this guy. He's humble and just sitting there as exactly like an ordinary person distributing flyer for his faith." That's it, and thank you for taking my call.
Thanks for your call.
You know, one of Ali's closest friends said to me he was really humble, and it shook me for a minute. I had to think about it. You know, how could a guy who goes around calling himself the greatest all the time be humble? A guy who drives, Rolls Royces, but what the caller Muhammad just said is right. He never really thought he was better than anybody else. He would sit on a park bench and just talk to strangers all day long. He would stand out and just hand out pamphlets one at a time, promoting Islam, not promoting himself. And he would travel with these giant heavy suitcases full of pamphlets wherever he went. And there was a kind of humility about the guy.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Was he able to be humble when it was established that everybody around him agreed that he was the greatest?
That helped. I mean, he loved attention. He would stop traffic just to see what would happen, just so that the world could enjoy him more. And, his wife said to me, he cheated relentlessly with other women. But she said, I think he was mostly just doing it because he thought he could spread more joy to the world, that, it wasn't even about him so much. He just wanted to make all these women happy. And sometimes he would say, well, I think she's going to remember this for the rest of her life. So I don't know if I'd call that humility, but he definitely felt a powerful need just to be loved.
We know that his speech slowed down. We've heard this, and it's certainly an effect of Parkinson's disease that sometimes that affects one's ability to speak. Was he cognitively impaired?
I think he was pretty aware of what was going on around him, but he was not able to communicate. And late in life, I think he may have lost some of his cognitive ability, his ability to understand what was going on around him. But for a long time, he was kind of trapped inside his body and couldn't speak the way he wanted to, which for Ali must have been very frustrating.
Do you think he or anybody else in the sport at the time that he was fighting understood the risks?
Oh, of course. They definitely understood the risks. Every fighter knew old fighters and could see how they called it punch drunk, see how punch drunk they were. And, you know, there'd be fundraisers for guys who were disabled, and Ali would show up and he'd always say, well, it's not going to happen to me. But he knew the risks, and after a while he began to see it. He actually began to question it. He would ask people, there are all these interviews that he did in the 70s, late 70s, where he would say, do you think there's something wrong with me? Do you think they say that I'm slurring my words? And, you know, he was having trouble sleeping. His thumb was starting to twitch, and he went to see doctors for it, but he kept fighting. So he was aware that something was wrong, and he just couldn't stop.
What do you think his legacy is today? How will he be remembered? I mean, you've written this book to give us a much more nuanced portrait of this person who went from being like a sports hero to a civil rights hero, but also a vilified figure to a beloved teddy bear figure, as you said. What do you think we'll remember about him, you know, a generation from now?
I think ultimately Ali will be remembered as one of our great rebel heroes, that we're a country that promotes, that was built on rebellion, that ought to embrace rebellion. We don't always, as we see now with our football players who are being discouraged from rebelling. But Ali, I think, will be remembered for generations to come as somebody who said that black people don't have to take what's given to them. Nobody has to take what's given to them. We have a right in this country to stand up for what we believe in. And he did that at great personal risk.
Does it surprise you that there are some people who are so bothered by the idea that athletes might express a political opinion before a game begins?
Yeah, I'm shocked by it, because I don't think you see that people. You don't see people saying that actors shouldn't be allowed to express their political opinions. I think there's a degree of racism in it. I think if these weren't African American athletes, we wouldn't be raising such a big to-do about it.
I want to know your impressions of the funeral, which was televised in many parts of the world for Muhammad Ali. It was a sort of grand affair. Was it the sort of send-off he would have wanted?
Yeah, because he loved attention, and here it is. I mean, I can't think of anyone else who would get that kind of a send-off today. Tens of thousands of people just lining the streets to watch the hearse go by, and then 10,000 more filling an arena, and then another ceremony for the Muslim rites to be administered, packed with thousands of people. And just, you know, I interviewed guys off the street standing there who'd driven from Detroit, who'd driven from Florida, black people, white people, all just to say goodbye to somebody who they'd never met. And it was because he had touched their lives in so many different ways. It was one of the most remarkable things I've ever seen.
Jonathan Eig is a contributing writer to the Wall Street Journal and author of the new book, Ali, A Life. He's also working on a documentary version of the biography, right?
Yeah, that's right, for PBS with Ken Burns.
All right, Jonathan, thank you so much for making time for us.
Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is our technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. And Jeff Whittington is executive producer. We're on Facebook and Twitter. The handle is at KERA Think. You can find the podcast at think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.